thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source.
Dr. Stephen Leib has over a quarter century of investment experience. His focus is on the growth stocks, but so many other key areas, including the precious metals, economics. He's the former editor of Personal Finance. That was one of the most widely read financial newsletters, over 100,000 subscribers at its peak. Welcome back, Dr. Leib.
Thanks, Chris. And incidentally, I have an end of August deadline for my gold and China book. That may be my final one, but China means for gold. It means very good things.
We're clearly interested in hearing your thoughts. It's been a fun several months after several years in the doldrums. People getting rather excited, you know, with 18 central bank rate cuts in just the past few months this year. And then, of course, the Fed now beginning what appears to be a new rate cutting cycle. Tell us more.
Well, I think, we've been through rate cutting cycles before and things like that. But I think one of the big events that escaped a lot of people's attention was a change in direction by the Bank of International Settlements, BIS. Recently, BIS is not an organization noted for making headline announcements. I mean, you really have to read over a couple of hundred pages. And to be honest, I doubt that I would have seen the relevant paragraphs had I not read something else that had, you know, kind of directed me toward it. But what they did very recently, Chris, is for those that might not know, and admittedly that a few years ago that might have been me, but for those that might not know, the Bank of International Settlements is really, you know, often called the central bank of central banks. And they set rules that banks tend to follow, that other central banks tend to follow and pass on to their member banks. And back in 2013, if you were following the gold market, you might remember that gold, it sure surprised me. I mean, it took a dive. It really did. I mean, I think a lot of people expected it to go back to its high. I have to admit, I was one of them. And a lot of my reasoning at that point was based on the fact that I expected the BIS to come out and say that banks on their balance sheet could treat gold as if it were cash. It was a riskless asset, so that you don't have to take a haircut when you're calculating ratios. How much risk do you have? If you have gold on your bank as a bank asset, it counts as no risk. And just like cash, the Bank of International Settlements did not do that. And you could just sort of see, I mean, it wasn't apparent what they had done. Again, I mean, they write white papers every month, and I mean like 200-page white papers, and it was hard to miss. It was hard to see that they weren't doing what they were expected to do. But this time around, in I think March, they absolutely did that. They said that gold and cash are the same, and that's a very, very big deal. Because what it means is that commercial banks, lending banks, et cetera, can now hold gold on their balance sheets as a substitute for cash. Now, you know, there's good and bad to that in that gold can go down, but it can go up. And if you look at gold from any long-term perspective, and, you know, don't compare it to the stock market, compare it to cash, and, you know, the numbers, let's say, from the mid-1920s, admittedly that's almost 100 years, but the numbers are so compelling that they tell you why banks might want gold. You know, during that period of time, gold, I think, went up, I don't know, two or three-fold, something like that, whereas cash went down by 95%. So, you know, from any longer-term perspective, you want to have gold on your balance sheets. And that could be one of the main reasons that gold is really taking off here. And this is particularly beneficial to China because, at least according to what I read, I mean, China is very opaque, But from what I read, China has by far the most gold in the world, not necessarily their central bank. I mean, I'm not one of these people that, you know, really believe in conspiracies that their central bank is, you know, deliberately understating how much gold they have, although I don't dismiss that. That could be happening. But it really doesn't make any difference. If the gold in their banking system and held by their major banks amounts to, you know, what people think could be up to 20 or 30,000 tons, they are sitting in a wonderful position. And, you know, one of the theses of the book is that China wants a gold-backed monetary system. It doesn't mean that they want the yuan to be at the center of the system, but they want it to be part of the system. They want other currencies to be part of the system. It's sort of like an SDR, but it will be backed by gold, kind of a floating gold rate, you know, because it will be used in all trading transactions, and there's just not enough additional gold in the ground to assume that you'll, you know, be able to add a lot of gold to what's there that's going to be backing up the system. So gold prices will rise. And they could rise. I mean, it could be, you know, an incredible bull market. There's just not that much gold in the world. And not all of it's going to be available for central banks to back international transactions. So gold is going to have to go up to, you know, very, very, very high values. This is not a call for tomorrow. It's not even a call for this week. Indeed, it wouldn't surprise me if gold went back down to 1350, 1360. To go much lower than that, though, actually probably would surprise me a little bit, I'm being honest. But this could be the start of something big, what we're seeing right now. Again, not a straight-up bull market, but this could be the start of a sustained, a point of inflection, if you will, in the entire monetary system, which I just think is totally out of whack. So, you know, what informs this thesis is that China has been doing some very, very good things, and the United States has gotten incredibly sloppy over the past 30 years or so. The United States, in my opinion, was the greatest country civilizations have ever seen. Probably for the first generation or so after the Second World War. It was just a fantastic country. But since then, we've really been slipping. And China, I think, took lessons from us, to be very honest. Lots of things wrong with China. You won't catch me living there, though my son is married to a Chinese girl who is my daughter-in-law. But I'm sort of happy to see that, but it means you can go to China if things really got bad here. But you wouldn't see me there. I'm someone who doesn't particularly like authoritarianism, even writ small, never mind writ large. But I think that China is doing some very, very good things. I think we're very lucky, to be very honest, that I don't believe this is a country that aspires to control the world. I think that they want to have a lot of control over the East and developing countries. I think they believe that they're going to need tremendous amounts of commodities, which is something that informs their own need and desire for a gold standard. And if you go back, Chris, and, you know, look at some of the statements they were making in 2009, and this is, you know, this is a matter of public record. The PBOC chairman, I never can get his name right, actually basically came out with a statement. He's saying, look, we want a monetary system which includes a basket of currencies like the SDR and is backed by a commodity. And the only commodity that would fit the bill would be gold. So, you know, I think that that's sort of where we're headed, and I think this might be informing some of the reason why gold is headed higher. And if it is the fact that banks have finally caught on that gold is as good as cash as far as, you know, calculating all these necessary risk ratios.
I think you covered something we've talked about, so I won't harp on it too much, and that is the importance of learning from our trading partners. And I'd just like to quickly point out, how many coaches out there get angry at the opposing team after they've lost a match, or if they're in a series, a tournament, let's say it's a tennis tournament, let's say it's a baseball series, whatever it might be, they get back to the drawing board, don't they?
Bad ones don't. The bad ones just get angry and, sulk, and that's, and they don't end up in the profession very long. You're so right, yes. Just as a, parenting lesson, I mean, my two children, you could not believe. One is pretty bright and, tended to get very, very good grades. And I said, Willie, one time to him, I said, when he was disappointed that he didn't get like 100 on a test, I said, Willie, the only way you're going to ever learn is when you don't get hundreds, because that's when you pick up the book and figure out what you didn't understand or what you did not know. And when you win a game in baseball or football, I'm agreeing with you 100%. You don't really learn that. Well, you can learn. I'm being extreme here, but you really learn. You're so right. You're absolutely right. I agree. I couldn't agree 100 any more than I do. I mean, I've used that example many, many times. What you're saying.
Instead of pointing fingers, that's what I'm hoping we can do here, is kind of grow up a little bit, like you say our kids need to do. We're A students. We may be an A-minus student right now, but what we're going to do is learn by observing those who are doing a little better.
That's what the Chinese did, Chris. In my opinion, they saw what a great country we had. I mean, before we went off the gold standard, when we went off the gold standard, everything went kablooey. But, the example that I use over and over again, not just in a book, but, you're too young to remember, but when Sputnik was fired by the Russians and circled the Earth, we saw that. And we saw that as an opportunity to really step up and really improve. And you know what? In about a decade, a little bit more than a decade, we had a man on the moon, walking on the moon. And that's what we were able to do. Now we see Huawei coming out with great chips, taking the lead in 5G. So what do we try and do? Shoot down Huawei, which is crazy. And, we'll rely on some other foreign country, in this case, I guess, Sweden and Finland with Nokia and Ericsson. This doesn't make any sense. If we had tried to shoot down Sputnik when the Russians launched it, rather than use it as a sort of motivation to get on our horse and take the lead, it'd be an entirely different world. I couldn't agree with what, I think we're totally agreeing with one another, with each other, rather. You could either take it as, punishment and go cry in your room, or take it as a motivation to get better. And that's what we used to do. And what happened to that can-do spirit that we used to have in this country? It's not here right now. So I'm hoping that we can get it back. I really am. And I will vote for anybody that I think that can bring that back. Someone that really they can bring back that fighting spirit to our country.
Okay, so we've got a battle plan. We have a game plan. We've got a page, typed up. It's the executive summary. Here's what we need to do. So fill in the blanks here for us, Dr. Leib.
Well, I think that we basically have to, where this country, really went off is when we went off the gold standard. And that sort of gave us our cake and eat it too. It meant that we could print as much money as we wanted, that we didn't really have to worry about paying for things. We didn't have to worry about being frugal and planning. And sort of instant gratification became the rule of the day, rather than long-term planning. The three projects that I single out that took place in the context of that generation right after the Second World War are not projects, but three examples, more like it. The interstate highway system, that was about a 40-50 year project, and most of it was completed by the early 1970s, and it was a marvelous thing, and its cost came in under control, etc. Second was that you just have to go back to Bell Labs. Bell Labs was the center of, it still is, their inventions are the center of our technologies today, of China's technologies today. I mean, they out of Bell Labs came the transistor, came the internet, came the laser, came superconductivity, came information theory, even came the first evidence of the Big Bang.
You're Shockley and Dr. Noyce, and of course, they're Gang of Eight, right? They're rowdy Gang of Eight who dared to defy corporate America and start Fairchild Semiconductor, which incidentally very successful today. I found a website just doing a little basic back of the envelope research this week on Nikola Tesla. Now, you're a huge fan of collaboration among the cognoscenti. You also love the rogue wizard. Well, he was one of those rogue wizards. In 1898, Nikola Tesla gave a demonstration, I'm sure you're probably aware of a cordless, wireless, underwater submarine model in New York City. It required a rudimentary
transistor.
That's wild.
I have not only the link, I have the diagram with schematics and the write-up, and I'm sending it right now to your email address. We need the savant autistic type to help us get the little breakthroughs, but we also need the managerial, supervisory, and creative types as well.
That's absolutely right, and I think that you had both at Bell Labs. Is you had a company that was a subsidiary of AT&T, but actually actually Western Electric. And they really didn't work with budgets. I mean, they did have budgets. They also had as much time as they wanted to create these projects. I'm okay.
Because we have time.
Let me give another shot.
Okay.
These people were given as much time as they really wanted. Also, they basically were working not just with themselves. And there was an incredible group within Bell Labs. But they were also working with top universities, and they were also working with the government, with DARPA. And, you know, together, our best universities, the best of those people that were, you know, part of the Defense Department or the research aspect of the Defense Department, plus Bell Labs. And, you know, what they came out with was just, you know, remarkable. The internet was basically a Bell Labs invention. A Bell Labs conception, information theory, which was developed by this fellow, Claude Shannon. He was totally brilliant. And he published what he did, I think, at Bell Labs. He published it as a master's thesis. I can't believe what it is. I don't think he ever got a doctorate. But his master's thesis was a theory of what was the theory, still used. It's all about bits, zeros, and ones. That was Claude Shannon. You know, error correction. That came out, probably in the early 50s. Don't quote me on that, but it came out, and it was published as a master's thesis, and he was part of the Bell Labs team. With Shockley on developing the transistor, also worked on, he got two Nobel Prizes, one for superconductivity and one for the transistor, along with Shockley and somebody else, I can't remember their name. These inventions basically defined, you know, what our modern technology was. And I'll go one step further. The transistor, when it first came out, I still remember transistor radios. I mean, I'm an old guy, my goodness. I mean, transistor radios, they used a transistor in the back. And the transistor was large enough where you could actually, I think, take it out. And, today, they get literally 50 billion transistors in the space where they used to have one. Now, not the only reason, but one of the reasons that they were able to miniaturize and went up this incredible learning curve, I mean, just fantastic learning curve, was the fact that the government kept ordering millions and millions of transistors. And the only way that, companies, you mentioned Fairchild and later Intel, were able to, satisfy the demand for these transistors was, going up this learning curve. They knew that the learning curve existed. They knew that they could miniaturize, but they didn't really have the order flow to justify the work and the the machine tools and everything else that it would take to do it. The government provided the inspiration for doing that. So what you had, Chris, in the early part of this of the post Second World War period, was a country that worked together. I mean, the people that were capable of great research, they were given as much time and for practical purposes, almost as much money as they needed. They weren't held to a particular schedule. It wasn't quarterly to quarterly earnings, et cetera, as it is today. So it was an entirely different world. And as a result, the United States, I think during that period, and I, you know, do remember some of it, and it lasted through the 1960s by and large. I mean, toward mid-1960, it kind of started winding down a little bit. But it was probably the greatest generation any major economy has ever had. Any major economy has ever had. And we've got to get back to that kind of mindset. We really do. And, you know, two exceptions that sort of prove the rule would be, you know, if you need, you know, if you think of successful companies in this world, I mean, two names that certainly are going to be near the top of your list are going to be Berkshire Hathaway, run by Warren Buffett, and Amazon, run by Jeff Bezos. Amazon's only a 20-year-old company. But these are companies, I mean, if you look at their annual reports and Amazon's, one of their first letters to shareholders is that we are not going to be short-term thinking. We, and Buffett says the same thing. We don't care about our quarterly results. We don't even care about our yearly results. We care about, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years out there. I think one of the statements that Bezos made early on was that if people think in 3 year intervals, and we're willing to think in 7 year intervals, we have a much bigger edge. And he was able to convince shareholders that that's what he's doing. We've got to get back to that mindset, not just for two companies, but for the country as a whole, to think a little bit longer term. And, you know, I think we could rise again. I think it could be a very, very great country again.
This is very positive way of looking at it. We don't have to enter the downward slide that great empires of the past, you know, so many come to mind and are still remarkable countries, if you will, but they're no longer empires. We don't think of, I think, Great Britain as an enormous sprawling empire anymore. We don't maybe think of the Roman Empire as an enormous empire. We just think of Rome as a remarkable city, wonderful country. Obviously, we have to settle down as a country. I mean, we can't maintain this. I'd like to shift over, if we could, though, to the equities markets. You know, this is clearly an important topic for our listeners, and many people have watched this amazing breakout, you know, 120-year highs plus on the Dow Jones Industrials. Maybe not so much the Dow, but certainly the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. These shares have registered all-time record highs in recent weeks. We had 30% above the dot-com peak for the NASDAQ. In nominal, not real, but nominal terms. We need to make that distinction. Tell us more.
Well, as we were talking on the phone, it came across that Trump has tariffed China another 10%. I'm not sure on what goods. Maybe it's all the other goods that he hadn't tariffed before. And gold, which was down, is now up a little bit. But the market, which was up, is now down a little bit. You know, we're fighting through right now, I think, this sort of, you know, war between, you know, two powers, the East and the West. I don't think we're going to get to where we want to get to by tariffing other countries. I just don't think it makes sense. I think it makes much more sense to cooperate. I think, you know, going back to Bell Labs, going back to other research facilities that we had on the West Coast that were very important in, you know, conducting the war efforts, in World War II, you know, nationality, things like that really didn't make any difference. We would accept other nationalities if we, you know, people passed certain tests that told us we could trust them, et cetera. And we're not doing that here. And I'm not taking a stand against or for Trump or for anybody else, but this is no way to succeed by trying to, you know, shoot down Sputnik, so to speak. The way to succeed is not to, you know, try and cripple Huawei. The way to succeed is to build a better Huawei. And we are not doing that. And just as, again, as we were talking on the phone, you know, Trump all of a sudden tariffs, you know, the rest of China. And I didn't think those, I don't know what to, it's a little bit disheartening. I mean, put it that way. It's not going to stop China, but it may actually hurt America. It really may.
So it's important that you share these sentiments of yours, and because we have to entertain both sides. And I think there's some compelling evidence when we look back just over history. The Smoot-Hawley tariffs come to mind, right? See, on the one side of this argument, we have those sharp economists who recognize, maybe this is short term really good for the stock market and maybe seems good for the economy because certain sectors benefit well.
Yeah, but it also illustrates an unwillingness to work with others and try and create a better world for the world. And I think that this is probably, it's a very, very complex world. And it's difficult. But I don't think tit-for-tat punishments lead to win-win situation. I mean, I don't think you have to view the world as zero-sum. I think you can view it as win-win.
And, John Nash is the Nash Equilibrium. So he points out that you nearly always orchestrate. I mean, this is, one of the first classes we took in quantitative economics was the, this Nash Equilibrium was one of my mentors, actually, his thesis. At any rate, that's so essential to recognize that you can almost always orchestrate a win-win situation if there is fair negotiation and cooperation among closely. Is there anything else on the topic you'd like to go into?
Just that, I think that, gold makes a lot of sense. Gold also went from down about $9 when we started talking to up $5 right now. And the market it was up about 1%. Now it's actually down. I don't think that the world doesn't like slower growth. China doesn't have a history of backing down. I mean, right now, if you look at sort of a brief history of China over the last couple of hundred years, you see a country that's been terribly embarrassed by, Japan, Korea, etc. They don't want to be embarrassed again. They're not going to back down. Who comes out better in a tariff war? I really don't. I mean, both, if you read this economist, we do. If you read another economist, China does. It just doesn't seem to be a good way of going about things. I think we'll get through it. we do it. Maybe, someone will wake up and realize that, the way to solve this problem with China is to get on our horse and start developing, better chips, better this, better that. China is ahead of us in quantum computation right now. These tariffs, what they do is that they inspire China to do everything inside. In a couple of years, China won't need us for anything.
I think it also inspires, as you say, desire to circumvent the dollar reserve currency.
Totally, Chris. Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. I mean, what the United States has going for it today is that it's still the world's reserve currency, which means that they can impose sanctions on lots of other countries. But, if we lose that, I mean, we're no longer, in any way number one. It's not the end of the world. I mean, we can be shared number one. We can be number one in the West. We can still live a great, great life for us, for our kids, for everyone. But it's hard to do it as if your mindset, is basically just fighting and just, it just is not the way, I don't want to sound like 60s or whatever, but this is not based on that. This is just based, at least in my opinion, on just solid economic reasoning. I think the Chinese are very willing to share. And they have a lot to share. They're ahead of us in quantum technologies right now. They really are. Quantum communications, they're probably two years ahead of us. They're certainly ahead of us in 5G. That's what the whole Huawei thing was. And they're going to, employ 5G along the Belt and Road, which is going to be over half the world. This is not a good way of doing things. And I'm still hopeful that we'll wake up. I really am. And I'm also, to some extent, hopeful that I'm wrong. Maybe this will work. Maybe we'll end up, becoming number one again, through a route that I don't consider, a good one. Maybe I'm wrong. And I'd be very, very happy to be wrong on this one. Very, very happy. Trust me, very happy. I'm at the age where I want my kids to live a good life. No, I've had my chance. So, you know, I hope I'm wrong, but at least the way I look at it right now, this does not seem like a good idea.
And I just point out, you know, we had Dr. Paul Craig Roberts on the show who really corroborated your thoughts. He believes that one of the reasons why research and development, and obviously what economists refer to as capital investment, has been so sluggish, as I think you've aptly pointed out, in recent decades. What happened was it was legislation, once again, that Congress actually told CEOs, you cannot earn more than $1 million. And so as a result, they turned to buybacks in order to boost their stock options of their companies and, you know, to boost the price, the share price, so that their options would appreciate accordingly. The research and development has suffered because the funds that would have been earmarked for research now go back to buying their shares. At least that's a component of what he's concerned about.
No, he's right. I may disagree with him on some of the reason that that came about, but basically, I totally agree with him. I mean, in this country right now, it's quarter to quarter. You know, how much does your share price go, and how are your earnings, and how is it going to affect your stock price? And you're rewarded on how your stock does over, let's say, a 12-month period. But that's a very short-term period. How long does it take to come out with a new breakthrough kind of invention? I mean, CRISPR, that came out of Berkeley or MIT, depending on who you believe in the patent debate. I mean, this was a decade-long project, at least 15 years. I mean, is there anything that's taking 15 that we have under development now that has a lifespan of 15 years of research behind it? Not that I know of, but I can tell you that China does. And I think that we're a little bit hypocritical when we, you know, not a lot, because they're, you know, like I said, I am not pro-Chinese. I don't want to live there. I don't want to live under an authoritarian state. I just don't want it. It's not my type of thing. But you have to say that there's a little bit of hypocrisy when we come down on them for their state-owned enterprises, which work with the government, which work with universities, and do exactly what Bell Labs was doing in this country that made this country great. China's following us. We set the example. Well, we have to set the example for ourselves.
Can you give us your parting comments for investors? Maybe you'd like to just outline for the rest of the year where you might be constructing a portfolio. Hypothetically, of course, we don't give specific investment advice. That's not our core mission here. But we do like to help people get in the right direction and make sure their family is safe and productive and effective in the investment area. Maybe you'd just like to share any other topicality.
I mean, I think that investors, I mean, I'm sort of speaking for myself, and again, I'm not giving anybody any advice. I think they should have at least 10% of their assets in gold. I think it's just utterly necessary at this point. In terms of the stock market, we've had an incredibly fractured market where, you know, you've had stocks like Facebook, Amazon, et cetera, just going to the moon. And, you know, it was a lot of fun for a while. I think you might see some shifts here. I think you might see investors gravitating toward inexpensive stocks, stocks that are so-called value plays. I mean, I'll just give one example, and I won't say whether I own it or recommending it or anything else, but a stock like CVS is a very interesting stock. They're trying to deal with all the vagaries of the healthcare system, which is a weak spot in this country, and I think that they have a very, very good plan. And they're dirt cheap, and they have a yield. And, you know, one thing that is nice about the stock market is that with bonds yielding less than 2%, you could find many, many stocks that are yielding, you know, 4, 5, even greater percentages. And some of them are, you know, blue chips in the energy patch. You know, I gravitate right now, and for most of this market, I was not. But now I'm gravitating toward what I would call these so-called value plays, the banks, Bank America. They have a decent yield. They're buying back their own shares. I know that's a bad thing long term, but banks are not where the inventions are. You're going to find the inventions. So I think it's okay. They have decent yields, et cetera. The airlines are I think, you know, another area where they rationalized the entire airline industry over the past 10 or 15 years. There are a few dominant players like Delta, UAL, et cetera. I think that's an interesting place to look. So basically, I've kind of done, you know, in my publication right now, The Complete Investor, I basically am focusing ever more on stocks that don't have super high PEs, stocks that are not going to get, you know, incredibly frothy if this market goes up. And I think the market will go higher, incidentally. I do. But I'm focusing on, you know, the sort of value sector, which is so dramatically, the word dramatic doesn't really capture it, but it is so dramatically undervalued relative to the rest of the market. And you can, if you look in that sector, and I think I hopefully have given a few ideas, you will find stocks that not only cheap by, you know, PE metrics, book value metrics, any metric you want, but also pay you a decent income and a growing income in many, many cases. Even some of the drug companies are fairly good as far as that goes. That's sort of what I would look, but you know, at least for me, I definitely would have some money invested in gold.
We just wanted to thank you so much for your time and looking forward to more about the recovery and the new upcoming bestseller, which we know it will be.
I hope it helps at least one person, and then I'll feel like I did something. You know, it's always great talking with you, and I had a ball.
I'm sure our listeners will feel that enthusiasm. Let's hope that it does help a bunch of folks today. And let's talk soon.
Okay, great, Chris. I always love talking to you. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Shopping for fine jewelry just got easier. GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Many Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share, with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Many Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Many Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Many Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange and in the US MENEF. Remember to sign up to Many's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Many Jewelry.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.